Hello and welcome to the Conservationists Assembled podcast, the podcast that seeks to join forces with the world's mightiest wildlife warriors in order to promote awareness and drive change to ensure species survival for those that call our planet home. Whether you're a veteran in conservation or new to animal advocacy, this is the podcast for you. Today's episode is all about the Goeldi's monkey with our expert guest Susan O'Brien. So what do you stand to gain from today's episode? Coming up, Susan and I discuss how these primates are so unique compared to their close relatives. We also discuss some of the projects that exist in order to give these monkeys a chance of survival, and we gain an insight into what we should and should not be doing to minimise the risk of human activities in their home range. So grab a seat, get comfortable, and please welcome Susan O'Brien to the Conservationist Assemble podcast. So Susan, thank you for joining us today on the podcast. How's it going?
Oh, going great. Thank you. Yes. Yeah. Thank you very much for having me on.
Oh, you're very welcome. I'm glad you've joined us today. We're here to talk about the Goeldi's monkey, and I can't wait to hear your thoughts. So naturally, first place to start then, what is a Goeldi's monkey?
Well, a Goeldi's monkey are a Calimico. Apparently, I've been told my Irish accent is not very forgiving, so I call them Goeldi's monkey, and people are like, huh? What's that? So I usually say Calimico, so it's a Calimico Goeldi. And basically, they're a beautiful, small South American species, lovely little kind of black-coloured monkey. They're probably small squirrel size, I suppose, would be kind of the easiest way for people to think of them. They live in kind of family groups. You'd find them in rainforest kind of areas. They'd be in kind of lower kind of understory of rainforest. Live in family groups, usually you'd have a kind of breeding pair and their offspring then that kind of hang around with them as well. So, yeah, part of the Calotricid family. And they're actually quite interesting. The Goeldi's monkey, they're not really a tamarin, they're not really a marmoset. They kind of fall in a kind of middle line there. So they're kind of out on their own. And they actually have one of the most evolutionary distinct, this edge figure they give. They've quite a high edge figure there. So they're very, very genetically distinct from all the other Calotricids, basically.
Oh, that's really cool. So there's a lot of research going into these eyes and to find out exactly what they are and where they fit into their own niche.
That's it. I know a lot of places sometimes they're called Goeldi's monkeys, Goeldi's tamarins, Goeldi's marmosets. So they're not quite one or the other. They're kind of out there on their own. They're also kind of unique within the Calotricid family in that they only give birth to single offspring. Whereas most Calis, as you know, GLTs or, any of the other species, any of the marmosets usually would have twins. So they're quite unique in that regard as well.
Oh, that is really unique. I wonder why that is. So then, despite how different they are, and obviously I'm assuming they share, their habitat with other species of tamarin and marmoset in the wild, but what role do they play within their wider ecosystem?
Well, these little guys, there's not a huge amount known about them in the wild. They're one of the most recently discovered primates in the world. They were only kind of discovered, I think it was 1904 in the last kind of century. So, and if you imagine, they're quite small, they're like jet black, kind of dark brown. They have amazing camouflage. They just melt into the background. So we don't have any data even on how many individuals there are actually out there in the wild as well. Looking at other species, though, I'd imagine they'd be quite, part of the ecology for seed dispersal would probably be one of the major ones for a lot of these different species. But they're probably similar enough to other tamarins and marmosets as well. But for that particular species, we just don't have the data to know what's going on with them.
So in terms of them not knowing numbers, but do we know their kind of classification? Are they, despite being newly discovered relatively, are they doing okay? Are they endangered?
They're again the same kind of, we're kind of going, they don't have exact numbers, but they can say that they are vulnerable. Their population is definitely decreasing, and populations that they would have seen previously have definitely decreased, or they're just not being seen again in these different kind of areas. And they're also they're a species, probably one of the most widely distributed species in South America, primate-wise. You'll find them spread from, Brazil, Peru, Colombia. So it's huge, huge areas that they live in, but it can be quite patchy and fragmented. So again, even if there is these little populations, how are they even getting together to, produce or, increase genetics as well? So it's another kind of issue with them as well. But definitely, I think with all of these South American species with, you know, agriculture, human encroachment. Anywhere there's a road, there's going to be people going in and logging. There's road traffic accidents, the pet trade. So there's all these different issues affecting all kind of primate species in South America. So I would imagine they would be the same.
So then, to touch on, you know, talking about how could these animals possibly create or keep genetic variability going in the wild due to habitat fragmentation, that leads nicely into part of your role as a zookeeper, because you're actually the EEP coordinator for the Goeldi's monkey. So could you please just talk to us a bit about the role and the function of the EEP?
Yeah, absolutely. So I know it can be, there's a lot of acronyms and stuff kind of thrown around with EEP. So that basically means it's an ex situ program, that we, an ex situ endangered program. So we manage these animals outside of their wild native area. And so my role, I'm the European coordinator. So basically I coordinate the population within all the European zoos who are part of EASA. And EASA, we all know EASA is the European Association of Zoos and Aquaria. And within, they have all these, they have so many different hats that they kind of put on. But the Calotrichia tag, our taxon advisory group, would hold, I think we have 18 EEPs. So basically, you know, there's like the golden line tamarin, there's the red-bellied tamarin, there's the common marmoset, all of these different species that we manage as an EEP. And there's a coordinator then for each one. So I, as I say, happen to be the one for the Goeldi's monkey. Yes. So basically, there's a huge amount of kind of paperwork and you know, I use PMX as like a population management computer program. Basically, I suppose with any kind of captive population or zoo bred population, you're trying to have a viable, healthy, fit population that you can manage, you can maintain it demographically and genetically, and also holistically as well. So there's all these different kind of factors that you have to kind of bring, you know, to the role. And I suppose basically for any population, you need to have feet on the ground. You need to have numbers to keep it viable. Then I'd say that your genetics would kind of come into it. So what are the most valuable animals? And I mean, all of this genetically, we don't tend to put a monetary value on animals in EASA zoos anyway. So genetically valuable animals. So maybe animals that don't have many relations within the population. So there's loads of lovely acronyms. So mean kinship or an MK ranking. So the number one animal on the MK ranking has the least amount of animals related to it within my zoo population. And the higher this MK ranking goes, the more relations they have basically in the population. So their genes have been well spread basically is what that means. So genetically, then you try to focus on these low mean kinship animals. So you want to get your you know, your top 10 MK animals to breed all together. And it all sounds wonderful and very easy, but then you have to take into account how old are these animals? Are they already in a family group? Where are they based in the world? Do they need to travel crazy distances to get to each other? Are there holders available to put animals into? So there's all these different, you know, there's pros and cons to everything, I suppose. And you're trying to juggle and balance everything to kind of make it work as well. So it can be very rewarding, but it can also be very tedious as well. And there's many nights at home I'd be, you know, there with a bottle of beer trying to, you know, pull my hair out and trying to figure out things. But we usually get there in the end.
So then I suppose to touch on kind of keeping that mean kinship low number low, would the fact that Goeldi's monkeys only have one offspring help, or would that be kind of a disservice to your role?
I think it's actually probably easier to manage because there's less of them coming up. So in some ways I'm very, very lucky. My population was very, very well managed. Previously the EEP for Goeldi's kind of started in the 70s, as far as I know, and it's been very, very well managed. There's also an international stud bookkeeper as well, and that have done just huge, huge amounts of work. So I'm very lucky I was able to just like swan in, and the kind of hard, you know, groundwork have been done, and I just have to try and not you know, crush the population basically. So I'm trying my best. But I suppose as well, like the role with it as well, that you're trying to, you're dealing with people quite a lot in different holders and different zoos, and you know, everybody wants to breed, everybody wants babies, so you have to really be careful in how you manage situations and approach people. And Sometimes I think you have to look at it's very easy to look at a data sheet of numbers and not think this is a real live breathing animal that has feelings and sentiments. And, you know, we have to be, I think, very aware as a coordinator about that. And maybe it's okay, this animal genetically isn't an amazing animal to breed. It's not fair to have it by itself, or, you know, so is it better to keep it and let it breed and manage the outcome kind of further down the road? I personally think it is, and I think we have to look at it that way. I think the fact that they only have that one single birth, it can give me a bit of breathing space then to move animals on. They can often have two infants in a year if they're, you know, the gestation is roughly five and a half months. So they can have two in a year. Whereas if that was a tamarin or marmoset, it could be four individuals, and those four individuals will then have to go on to be placed at some stage. Sure. So you can get, you know, the family groups exploding very, very quickly. So yeah, it definitely gives me a bit more breathing space to kind of manage. And I suppose when you're trying to coordinate, you're trying to be as proactive as possible and know, okay, I've, you know, offspring being born here in 2 or 3 years' time, where am I going to place these individuals when they start to naturally kind of disperse themselves? And you'll often get kind of group fractures. So, which is normal, it's part of it. We'd always, you know, kind of recommend with the tag, if you are keeping any kind of calotrichid, you have a safe area you can move an animal to if it is ousted from the group. Because over the lifetime of you keeping them, chances are it is going to happen as well. So again, it's about trying to be as proactive with these recommendations as possible as you can be.
That's interesting to hear that it's as multifaceted as, you know, considering what's going to happen to an individual should it become solitary, and obviously knowing that that's not the dynamic of small primates. Because, yeah, on paper, you know, from an outside perspective, you would just associate with a breeding program that you're going to have the baby and almost you don't really consider much past that. So it is interesting to see how multifaceted the role of an EEP coordinator
definitely,
is.
Definitely. And I always say to people, even if you're not actively breeding your group, you're still such a hugely important part of an EEP. We need to have holders that are willing to hold non-breeding groups. And, you know, for us, we can't function without holders there willing to, you know, keep these animals and all the different various social groups you can keep them. And so for us, yeah, we need to have holders on board. And I suppose, like we'd always say with this MK ranking, it's dynamic. It's changing every time an animal is born or dies. This MK, it's moving all the time. So even if you can't breed this year, maybe you can breed next year. We just don't know what's going to happen. So, I'd always try and say, please try and be as, you know, patient, I suppose, with coordinators. Most of us, I think, are trying our best and trying to keep everybody happy. It can be a tough gig.
Absolutely. I think it's obviously incredibly important to let the listeners know that being an EEP coordinator has no monetary incentive. You know, it's something that you do just as an extra part of what's already a jam-packed role as a zookeeper or a curator or whatever role you're in. It's just an addition, isn't it? It's not its own thing. And yeah, so that patience is I can probably be sure is something that you do very much require.
Appreciated. It's appreciated. Definitely. Yeah. No, it is tough. And I suppose, like, there's nothing more rewarding than, you know, seeing a pair, maybe a young pair coming up in, you know, different parts of Europe, and you're like, yes, they're going to be, I can get these together at some stage in the future. And then maybe that happens, maybe a new holder comes on board. You can move these pair out there and then they go on and produce babies. It's fantastic to say, yes, I was a part of that. I made that happen. Like, it doesn't get much better than that.
Fantastic. Yeah, I could tell it means a lot to you just by having this call to you. So what then, going kind of back to their threatened species, you obviously know then what zoos are doing to help ensure kind of a survival for them, and obviously not knowing a lot specifically about the Goeldi's monkey, but being able to assume their threats in the wild, what actions need to happen globally for a better future for these monkeys?
Well, I think as well, again, as I say, I don't know specifically for the Goeldi's. There's no actual conservation organization in the wild for Goeldi's monkeys. So they do find, they would come through various kind of rescue centers and stuff in South America, I suppose. but there's nothing kind of specifically for them. But I think for a lot of people, it's always going to be what an individual is doing, little small steps. What can you do yourself at home? Are you recycling? Are you watching out for, you know, palm oil? Can you reduce your meat consumption every week? If everybody just did one little thing, it would collectively just make such a huge kind of difference. I suppose people need to be very aware of the whole pet trade. You know, that's still a huge thing, and especially for calotricid species, they're small, they're cute, they look like, you know, little pocket monkeys, and there's a massive issue we have had actually, and this is both in, I know, in Ireland, I'm sure it's the same in the UK, where marmosets are kept as pets, and then they go a little bit wild or feral, and we haven't had many calls recently, but in the past, people trying to surrender their pet monkeys, and we're like, well, what do we do? We can't take them in. They're hand raised. We can't just lob them in with our group of Gwaelodes monkeys here and expect them all to get in. But, you know, that's not really how it works. And a big issue that's affecting a lot of species in the wild is invasive species. So two of the biggest ones we're having at the moment, the jacus and the pencillata. I think it's the common and the, I always get that mixed up, I think the buffy eared one or the buffy tuft, one of them, and two of the marmoset species. So they're basically very, very common in the pet trade. And what happened is as well that they, instead of owners surrendering them, they just let them loose. Oh, let them back out into the wild. And that might be 100 miles or 200 miles away from their original, you know, native area. And then these animals can be quite, I suppose, I don't want to say aggressive, but they can be more dominant, say, over different resources. So food resources, nest sites, and they end up running out the local native species to that area out. So, I mean, this is a huge issue. And another big issue with these, the common marmosets, is that they can hybridize with all the other tamarins, different marmosets. And this is having like absolutely devastating effects on all the various different species and populations out there at the moment. So, I'd always say to people, if you know, even if you see stuff online or someone wants to, you want to hold a monkey on holiday, ask yourself, what am I supporting here? Why is this monkey not with its, you know, why is it here in human care when it should be out in the wild, you know, with its own kind of social group? And just people need to stop and think a bit more, I think.
Yeah, and I think that's it's specifically, you know, with a lot of small primates, but we're seeing it now with a lot of species in general. I know one of the first episodes I did with Jason Palmer on otters, we've talked about how Asian short-clawed otters are also, you know, being seen quite frequently on social media in domestic settings, and how even just, you know, interacting with not necessarily the right form of exotic animal on social media can be detrimental. So I suppose, again, it's now time to kind of drive home the point that it's okay to like animals on social media, but follow, you know, zoos on social media, doing things very reputably. If you need to get that fix of an exotic animal while you're scrolling through Instagram, there are reputable places out there to do it. It's just, yeah, like I say, having that conscious decision of
absolutely
which one you're going after. What, aside from the EEP, what else do zoos do for helping these guys in the wild then?
Well, I guess we have a lovely South American section here. So we also keep a few of the different species. We've, you know, white-faced sakis, Bolivian squirrel monkeys, golden line tamarins, we've our geldies, we've sloths, we've Central American wood turtles, we've Bedford tortoises, we've a lovely kind of mixture there. So one of the things that Dublin Zoo has supported is the Golden Line Tamarin Association, which are based out in Rio in Brazil. And we've supported them. I think it was one of the very early YASA campaigns. It was the rainforest campaign. And this is back 2001, 2002. And we've just continued on since then. So every year they will receive a donation from Dublin Zoo. So the money that comes into the zoo from gate receipts here, or people, you know, buying membership or spending food in the restaurant, that will go back, a percentage of that will go back to animals in the wild, with our kind of conservation partners there as well. So that really works. We also try and educate. So even though, for example, with the Gwaelodes monkey, that we don't have a conservation partner in the wild, we can still say, okay, We're keeping them in a proper social kind of group. As you say, we're not dressing them up in nappies and they're not riding around on bicycles. They're kept in a nice, you know, naturalistic looking enclosure or habitat. And this is how we should be keeping them. And I think we have a duty of care as a zoo to show that to the public and basically practice what we preach, you know, that we're not all, you know, we're not too hands-on with animals. I think a lot of it can be kind of gimmicky and, you know, it's not really, we have to show respect and we have to start in the zoo to animals and how we keep them kind of properly as well. And there is another, again, this goes back to the invasive species. There's two different species out in Brazil. I should actually, I don't know the exact area where it is. Manaus in Brazil. My horrible Irish accent, not the best. But basically, it's the Mountain Marmoset Conservation Organization. And there's two species there they're looking at. The Calotrix, is this the buffy-headed marmoset and the buffy-tufted ear marmoset? So Flaviceps and Arita. I have to write that down because there's no way I'd remember that.
They're very similar. So
very, very similar. So Flaviceps and Arita. And basically these guys, there's none of these animals in a zoo anywhere in the world, basically. They're literally only left in this very tiny, tiny area in the wild. And they're literally, we're going to see the species go extinct unless we do something to help them. So we're trying to kind of tell anybody who's keeping common marmosets that, okay, we know these are causing an issue in the wild, but we can still educate the public that come into your institution and tell them about the issues that are facing some of these animals in the wild. So even though there's no, we don't have a conservation partner for wildies, we can still say, well, we're supporting the Mountain Marmoset conservation program, and this helps because blah blah blah, and you know, it gives people a chance, I think, to I suppose gain a bit of ownership over something, and that they can become involved even if we don't have that particular species in a zoo as well.
That's fantastic. And I don't think I could have possibly put it better myself, because it is also then providing value to animals that are considered least concern, for example. You know, there's always that age old debate of, oh, all of zoos are here for endangered species, and why are animals at least concern housed? And obviously, if every zoo just housed endangered species, probably no one would turn up to go and see them, because a lot of the times no one really cares about the ones that are endangered.
And again, it's great when you have the lovely fluffies or the big, you know, beautiful big, you know, elephants or tigers, and people love them. What about the insects, the snakes and the spiders, that things that people aren't generally into? So I do, like, definitely, I think it's just a good chance to say, okay, if we can't do it, it basically is the same. If you can't rescue a dog or something, you know, if you can't rescue it, foster. If you can't foster, donate. And if that's money or time or, you know, resources that you can share with some of these organizations, absolutely get out and do it, I think.
Yeah, that's great. And yeah, shout out to the Mountain Marmoset Program, because that's, I mean, I'd never heard of it. So yeah, props to you for bringing that onto the light, and hopefully our listeners will check those guys out and the amazing work that they're doing. So we're getting towards the more lighthearted side of things now, because it can be quite heavy. What do Goeldi's monkeys mean to you?
I just think they're lovely. They're for such a small, little, innocent looking monkey, they have just massive like characters. They're really cheeky. I'd always say, you know, people would ask, oh, would it be okay to, you know, mix this animal with the Goeldi? And I'm always like, you just have to, like, they may look cute, but they can be absolutely ferocious. Like, for the size of them, you'd never think they'd have it in them. And like, I've had a few experiences here in my own time working with them where, you know, they be taken on like military macaws, like these birds that are like three or four times the size of them, and they're like, yeah, I'll have you, like, you know, pull on, and you're like, whoa, you know, they're just great, you know, that way. So no, I just think they can be real cheeky little characters, and they can be so, like, even when you see the babies being born and they're just so unbelievably tiny and delicate, and within, you know, a matter of weeks they're jumping around by themselves and, you know, giving you kind of attitude and stuff. They're great, real sassy little things. I like them.
And so, yeah, tell us about yourself and give us an insight into your background and your journey to where you currently are in your career.
Yeah, well, I suppose I'm here in the zoo now 20, I think it'd be about 23 years. So yeah, that's only a little bit terrifying. I don't think in Ireland we tend to move around as much as in the UK. And you know, like literally doesn't, we had, you know, there's probably Belfast Zoo and Photo Wildlife Park down in County Cork, and that kind of would have been it for years. And now we also have Emerald Park in the next kind of county over, and there is a lot more zoos kind of popping up around the place as well. But people tend to, we just stay put because there was nowhere else. You'd have to like move counties to go to a different zoo, so it didn't kind of happen. But like, I always just wanted to work with animals, and always. It's I my parents at home with a great picture. I'm dressed up, I have a dressing gown on back to front, and I'm wearing a shower cap on my head, and I'm operating on my teddy bear because I was going to be dead and save them. And I was only like 3 or 4 at the time. So it's just always been something I wanted to kind of do. And I suppose my dad would have been great. He'd always have us out, you know, bird watching and wildlife watching every kind of weekend. And we were always watching David Attenborough and stuff on the telly and that type of thing. So it's always kind of been in the blood. And we always had different pets and animals and stuff kind of growing up as well. And then when I was 15, I badgered my poor local vet into giving me a job there, basically. So I worked with him for about 7 years, which was amazing. And I remember my mom was saying, please stop bringing home animals. Just no more. That's it. Because every stray and waif that came in, oh, I'll take it, or I'll look after it. So there was a ban and embargo and then strays coming into the house. And I was there for a good 7 years. And again, he was he did a lot of work with birds, with parrots. So he would have worked with a couple of different stud farms. And he was quite good with exotics. So I got a lot of hands-on experience there. I did plan to do veterinary surgeon, and I missed out by about 100 points at the time. And I remember being devastated, but I said, right, I'm going to go back and do as a mature student. And I ended up going back to college and doing science, so applied science and microbiology and stuff. And then I was going to go back as a mature student after the first couple of years. Absolutely hated it. I was just like, what am I doing? It was so, I loved being in the vets and just being the hands-on and, you know, operations and really kind of getting stuck in. And to go from that to a sterile kind of lab environment with the goggles and the lab coats, it just wasn't for me. So in the meantime, I started working here in the grounds as like a casual kind of litter picking and stuff. And they said, look, if you get your qualification there and you have your animal experience from the vets, we'll take you on. And pretty much that's the rest is history kind of thing. So I've done more courses, and Sparshall, we have quite a big connection with Sparshall College in the UK. So I would have done the foundation degree in zoo resource management and the DIMSA, you know, the diploma course as well. And yeah, various bits and pieces then over the years here as well. So yeah, it's been good. And I think I've worked with everything from elephants to guinea pigs to sea lions to, so yeah, I've a nice repertoire of species I've worked with. And I know enough about everything not to kill them, which is just what you need kind of thing. So I can usually slot in anywhere, which is good.
quite the sought after trait. So yeah, you've mentioned, you know, you've got that diversity of taxes underneath your belt, and obviously, yeah, like we've been discussing, you're the EEP coordinator, but has there been one animal or species in your career that you've gained a particular attachment to?
Do you know, I always loved on the South America section, we had a lovely Brazilian tapir called Marmaduke. Oh my God, he was just beautiful. He was probably, we think he was the oldest male tapir in Europe. Anyway, he passed away he'd be 2 years ago now, the end of August. And it was a week before his 38th birthday, which is pretty good going for a tapir. But yeah, he was here from day one when I started here. You know, Marmaduke was here kind of thing. And he's just one of those kind of iconic animals that everybody in the zoo, would, on your way up, you will have worked with him on your way up kind of thing. And everybody knew him. And just a big softy, just a lovely, lovely animal to work with. And very steady. Anything new, or you know, he'd never panic or go galloping off. He was just, you know, slow, steady, nice and chilled out. And I was like, I want to be like Marmaduke and just have that sense of chill in my life, you know. So
definitely, yeah, there's a lot to be taken away from lowland tapirs. They're just like big puppies, don't they? Just love a scratch, love a trough full of food, and they're good. Oh, fantastic. I'm glad. It sounds like he would have had an impact on a lot of people's career. So yeah. What was your favourite part, or what is the favourite part of your role?
For the general zookeeping role, I just love it. Like, it's such a, do you know, I love even just going out into like a muddy paddock and trying to drive a buggy or a golf buggy through it and not get stuck. You know, little things like that you're like, where else would you get it, you know? And As I say, even like working, we have a young rhino calf at the moment, and she comes over and wants a bit of a scratch behind the ear, and you know, different things like that. Or we're trying to train our you know, giraffes at the moment, and you might get like that eureka moment where they, you can see that the penny is dropped, they understand what you're asking of them and they get it. And you know, it's all these little tiny magic moments that yeah, you just can't put a value on it really.
I agree. Yeah, it was probably hard to make you choose one particular favourite role. But yeah, I think you've put it very eloquently. Is that it also highlights no 2 days are ever the same. So how can you possibly necessarily have one favourite bit, because there's just so many factors within that role? What advice would you give to someone looking to pursue a career in conservation?
I'd say it is really difficult to get into. I don't think I would actually qualify to get into it now if I was applying for a position, you know, now with the experience that I would have had back then. I'd always say, and again, it's highly sought after a position, especially again in Ireland, there's not very many positions available. There, like, is there even 150 animal keepers in Ireland? I don't know, you know, so there's just not that many of us. And then people, again, like when you're here, you tend to stay. You don't ever tend to kind of leave or move careers. And I would say try and get as much hands-on experience as you can. If that's your local vets, if it's your local dog groomers, your local dog shelter, a pet shop somewhere where you can go and get that hands-on experience. And we have had a good few people come to the zoo as keepers, because they started to volunteer in like as a Dublin Zoo volunteer, and they kind of got in that way. And get qualified. There is any number of, you can go online, you can go to college, there's any number of resources out there available. It's not like some of them are Mickey Mousey, but I still think, yeah, it shows that you're interested, you've got that, you know, you want to learn, you want to gain that knowledge. And I think for employers going forward, they want to see that you're willing to learn and evolve, I suppose, with the career. And so, yeah, hands-on experience and qualifications, the two best things, I think, to get into it. And be prepared to, you know, it's tough. It is tough to get into. And I think even mentally, it can be quite a draining job, I think. Not draining, that's not the right word. Maybe taxing sometimes. And again, I would say, and I get to experience this, some days I'm like, I just want to work in the drafts today, and it's going to be physically demanding, but they're not going to check my locks when I walk away. Whereas the gorillas and the chimps are constantly like mentally stressed. Is this, you know, or did I lock that? Is this okay? Have I kept them busy enough today? Do I need to get them on enrichment? It's a totally different, I suppose, way of looking at animals, or like a stress kind of level with them as well. So yeah, some days I'm glad to have a little bit of a break from, okay, my back is a bit sore today, I'm going to head over to the gorilla section, or you know, vice versa, I need a break mentally, I'm going to go work on the rhinos today. Or not to take away from hoofstock keepers, everyone has their own stresses, but it's a different level of stress, I think.
Yeah, no, I get exactly where you're coming from. So yeah, we're going to just do some quick fire questions now, just to finish up on. So are there 1 to 5 dream species that you'd love to see in the wild?
Oh, I would. Well, I'd love to see Geldy's monkeys in the wild. That would be amazing. I was really lucky to see golden line tamarins in the wild in Rio. And I was so lucky. The zoo actually sent me over to visit our conservation partner over there. And geez, that was back in 2014. So I'm like, actually, it's a decade ago. I need to push. I need to go back for like a reunion and try and push that. And so that was just incredible. But I'd love to see, I think anyone that can see animals in the wild, they are so privileged. There's so many species in peril out there, and we don't even know it yet. So I would say, you know, if you can see anything you can in the wild, do it now while you can, kind of thing. And I suppose I'd love to see, I haven't visited Africa much. I'd love to go more to Africa. I've been to South America a few times. I just think the thrill of hearing, I remember hearing the golden line tamarins walking through the forest and hearing them and being like, this is so surreal, because I hear them at work every day. I recognize the sound, but to think this is them in the wild, it's just absolutely mind-blowing. I must say, it's that's one of my standout moments ever, working with them, the primates, and just hearing that noise and being like, holy moly, this is out like in the wild. Like, it's just crazy. So yeah, there's a lot of species like that.
Yeah, that's so cool. So then you might have touched on it. One country or continent that you'd love to visit?
I feel like I have to say South America, because I'm with the Calatrica tag, But I would love to visit Africa. I say I've done very, very, I've done a bit of the north. I've never done a safari or anything like that. And I'd just love to say experience it. And yeah, absolutely. That would be my big thing. That would be amazing.
Hope you get out there one day. Maybe you can lobby for Dublin to send you there as well.
That's it. That's it.
When you're not working, how do you keep busy? Like you've mentioned, it's quite taxing, either mentally or physically demanding. So yeah, how do you keep busy when you're not working?
Pretty much, I suppose I've two big hounds at home, and so they need a lot of exercise and general cuddles on the couch and stuff like that. And yeah, I do. I like to be out and about myself, and just go for a walk to the local forest and just feel that kind of connection. I know, as if I don't get enough of it in work, it's just nice to kind of get out and about. I absolutely love reading. I would read if there's a box of cereal on the table, I'm reading the back of it. I'm a ferocious reader. So yeah, I'm usually at home with a dog either side of me on the couch. My husband's usually on the floor in the corner because he doesn't get enough in, and I have a good book, and I am happy out. Yeah.
And lastly, then, what do you think is one takeaway our listeners should get from this episode?
I would always say, I think conservation, it's not another person problem or another country problem. It's an us problem, and it, like we hold the key to solving it. So, if every person, like I made a pact to myself, whatever, 5 years ago, I'm not going to buy plastic bottles anymore. Bottles of water, bottles of Fanta, no, I'm not doing it. If you get one free, no, thank you, I don't want it. I'll make a conscious effort to buy a tin or a can of 7-Up or something instead, or I'll get a cup, or a reusable cup that you hand wash. So that's one of the things that I try to do. I've cut back in meat, so I'm only trying to eat meat every other day as opposed to every day, which I would have done. And again, it's not a huge big thing, but if everybody did something little, small, simple. And the sad thing is that, like, we will have to make a sacrifice. It's not, nobody said it was going to be easy and you can just do this and it's going to be great. People are going to have to make sacrifices, and I think that's only going to get more pronounced as we move on and further into, climate change and all the issues kind of surrounding that as well. So if people can make those small sacrifices now and everybody does it, I really, really do believe that it will make a difference.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the kind of age-old phrase that gets thrown out is that we don't need one person doing conservation perfectly. We need hundreds and thousands of millions of people doing it imperfectly, for lack of a better phrase, just because it is, like you say, a global effort. So yeah, Susan, thank you so much for gracing the podcast with your presence today and sharing your knowledge on not just Goldie's monkeys, but everything. I could tell that they mean a lot to you, and you've got a kind of an unwavering dedication to welfare and education of these animals. So we'll be sure to keep up with everything that Dublin Zoo is doing in the future, and obviously the work of Goldie's monkeys as well.
That is brilliant. Thank you so much for having me on and listen to me waffle on about the little geldies.
And just like that, another epic episode of the Conservationist Assemble podcast has wrapped up. A big thank you to each and every one of you for tuning in. If you had a blast like I did, how about sprinkling some 5-star love wherever you catch your podcasts? Share the joy with your friends, family, or even your pet goldfish. The more the merrier. Got ideas to make the show even more awesome, or a species you're dying to hear about? Drop it in a review, our DMs on Instagram, or shoot us an email. Stay in the loop on Instagram for more ways to dive into the action, and catch you next time.